The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm here with another legend, another celebrity in the wine world, one of those famous winemakers in Chile. Francisco Beiteg is here from Vina Aracerez. How did I do, Francisco, on your last name and on the winery? I know I messed it up, but how did I do?
No, you did very well. You did very well. It's not easy to pronounce. Beiteg and Aracerez.
Yeah, so. Beiteg, I feel I'll get, but even when I was telling people I was doing this interview, I'm like, you know, the famous one. It begins with an E. There's two R's, that winery. And then everyone like, oh, Vino Chadwick. I'm like, yes.
Yes, exactly.
And then everything would be okay. I was wondering if you just tell a little bit about your story. Born in Santiago in 1969, which means I believe you're turning 50 this year. So,
yes, exactly.
And you were named. You came aboard in 2003 as the head winemaker. Did you feel any pressure considering the history? The family-owned vineyard had been around since the 1870s and one of the flagships of all wineries in Chile.
I did, and in fact, the first time Eduardo Chadwick, the owner, offered me the job, my answer was no.
Really?
Yes, because he hired me for Viña Caliterra, that is part of his group. Mm-hmm. And so I was working there when he offered me to take over Aracerez, and I was only 30 year old, and I said, no, I don't want to do that now. So, but he said, no, I'm not asking.
Yeah.
He's an order. So, yeah.
I always ask this question. Did you have a moment when you just realized that wine is what you wanted to get into, that, you know, that sort of epiphany moment when you realize this is where I need to spend my life?
Oh, it was a bit more of a process because in Chile, all winemakers are agriculture engineers. Mm-hmm. You have to study that first.
So and that was your, yeah, you studied at the University
of
Chile.
Yeah, so that was the first, like, choice to mm-hmm. get there. And then in the beginning of the 90s, when I had to make my choice for a specialization in agriculture engineer, wine export was just taking off. So for me, it seemed to be very interesting to be part of this new era of the Chilean wine production. So that's why little by little I went into that direction.
Was it in your family? Was, you know, because there's some people I interview where they don't like, they would only drink wine at Christmas or Easter. And then there's others where, you know, they were being slipped glasses of Grand Cru Burgundy at the age of 9. Yeah. I'm wondering, was it in your family?
No, yeah, my dad was for sure increasing the Chilean average wine consumption because he liked wine, especially red wine. And so, yeah, I had this image, and he was an agriculture engineer too, so that's why I went the same direction.
And then after the agriculture engineering degree, you went to Bordeaux University.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could just talk, what were some of your favorite memories of, I mean, what a different lifestyle to go from Chile to, Bordeaux's gorgeous, just what that lifestyle was like for you.
Well, I always wanted to travel and live overseas, so I was planning that for some time. Bordeaux at the time, when I arrived in 2001, wasn't what it is today. Today is a beautiful city, renovated, I mean, like a little Paris, but human scale. At the time, was not like that. They
really?
Had done a great job. It was a dark city with a lot of sooth and in the stone of the houses and no quay and so they have totally renovated, no tram. It was a little bit of a dark city.
Really?
I enjoyed it a lot anyway, but it's been into a huge transformation. It's my favorite city in the world.
Because I went there in 2015 for my 40th birthday, and I just thought this city is gorgeous.
It is today, yeah.
And what were some of, how did you change when you entered the Bordeaux University versus when you left? What were some of the main things that just you took away from your schooling there?
Oh, many things. The thing is that it was a post-degree. Mm-hmm. So you had, and the format was very interesting because you had different teachers almost every week. It wasn't like a fixed course from the beginning to the end. It was like subjects that were given by very, very high capacity people. So in different aspects, from winemaking, viticulture, and even environmental aspects. So it was very complete. And I learned a lot of different things that I after using in Chile. For me, the mix of knowledge that you have in France with intuition, because that's what I like in the French approach, that they use also a lot of intuition in the winemaking with a good background, scientific background, is very different from the New World approach that is more numbers and analysis, you know, like, yeah.
So New World much more just bottom line, and France more nuanced?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I read that you've worked France, California, Argentina, and Chile, Hallcrest Winery in California, Chevalier in France, Luton in Argentina, and of course all the work you've done in Chile. I know it's a hard question and there's no one answer, but I'm just curious, what are some of the biggest differences from working, and you sort of touched on it with your last answer, just working France versus California versus South America?
Well, California was a bit different from the average California because it was an organic winery, small, tiny, so we were doing like a few people doing everything, very committed to the environment. So it was a bit sui generis approach in California. Then Argentina, a bit more difficult viticulture, so because of the conditions there, so I learned a lot there too. So it's been a mix of experiences and learning, but overall I would say that New World has a tendency a bit to use more analysis and numbers, where the old world school is about letting things go and learning by experience, and I like that approach a lot.
So you prefer the more old world way of doing it?
In general, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think is there over-reliance on analytics and science in the new world when it comes to making wine? Yeah.
Yeah, I think there's a tendency to try to control things a bit more. And I think in the wine production, I mean, there's so many things going on, the climate that you cannot control, the condition of the temperatures, the behavior of the microorganisms. So at the end, you have a few tools that you should use, but I try to let things go and to interpret the terroir better than controlling everything.
I want to go down this route for a second, because when you were giving that answer, I was thinking about it. Do you think that in North America or just New World, and I'm not even saying this is a bad thing, because part of it's just human psychology, but do you think the over-reliance is out of a bit of fear or insecurity because you can't control the weather? So if you use all this technology and science, it's almost a way to make yourself feel better and feel less nervous because you just don't have the say. You can't control the weather. So do you think there's any sort of insecurity about the way we do it here in the New World?
It could be a little bit of that. Could be a little bit of that. I think, and don't get me wrong, the scientific information and knowledge is very important to, you can see the wines today, they're clean, they're properly made, but I think at some point the reflection of the origin and the terroir and the style of the wine should be a bit more terroir driven than trying to manipulate that too much. That's my approach.
Yeah.
But yeah.
How much do you think manipulation is just based on economics? I look at a lot of the, you know, really large mass-produced wines here. And a lot of them are good. Like, there's very good mass-produced wines.
Sure, yeah.
But then you get some where, you know, they've added a little extra sugar. And they're almost trying to make it so every year the wine tastes the same, which that's kind of not the point of wine.
Yeah, I think there's you look for a consistency, which is good. But at the same time, there's a lot of it's like a more industrial production at some point. You know, you use oak and you add oak and you add acid. You try to correct everything and to make it more like a simplification, but like a Coca-Cola thing, you know. Like, and I think wine is a bit of the opposite in a way. It should show what happened in the season, if it was a little bit warmer or cooler. Maybe not at the entry level wines, but when it's above that, I think it's let the expression of what happened in the season is important too.
In my research, you did work, or you're influenced by one of the most famous winemakers or consultants, however you want to call them, Michel Rolland. I'm just curious. I mean, this obviously a giant in the wine industry. What were your impressions of him?
Well, I've been lucky to meet and to work with a lot of very, very important and famous people, knowledgeable people. Michel, I was impressed the memory he had. He could consult many wineries, and he would know exactly the batches and the name of the people working there, etc. Because I did a visit in Bordeaux with him during a day. We visited 13 wineries, but he was very knowledgeable. But he knew what he was doing. He had a style and he stick to it. With time, I've been moving a little bit away from that style that I learned in Casa Labostol in Chile, where I work, that was a bit bigger wines and richer. And
yeah.
I moved into my own style today, but I learned a lot from him in terms of what wines shouldn't have, which is greenness and herbaceousness and to make clean wines, well-made wines. And then I have found my own style through time. But
how different of a winemaker are you now versus when you got started? What would you say, something like, if you could identify what you did early on versus now, what are some of the biggest changes in you?
It could be a long answer to give you, but I will try to make it short. In fact, in Chile, when Chile took off exporting in the 90s, there was very few winemakers that could available, very, very few. So a lot of winemakers were hired very young. So the style of what you were doing was more defined by the market and by the owner and the people above you, or even the consultant. So through time, I was more driven in the beginning by the what the market was demanding, especially US. And through time, I have developed my own style. I have traveled. I have visited Europe mainly, Burgundy, etc., etc. So I have changed into my own style. But that, for that, you need time. You need to understand what is your own taste and what you want to produce. And
yeah,
it's what I've been doing for the last 15 years, and it's never ends. But yeah,
where are your grapes sourced from? Which valleys is it in Chile?
In Chile?
Yes.
Aconcagua Valley, which is a valley a bit north of Santiago, 80 kilometers north.
By the way, I'm very sneaky here. I knew where it was. I wanted you to say the name of it because I always mispronounce
okay,
it.
Okay, good. Not easy either, Aconcagua.
And the reason was, I was just wondering if you could explain to everyone listening just what it is, what's the terroir, and just what makes that valley so unique.
Oh, it's a valley that is a bit farther north of the capital, Santiago, so it's warmer and dry, not problems of early rain, so you can ripe very well the Bordeaux varieties, but it's a very long valley, and this is in the central part, it's hotter, but in the coast, we have developed vineyards in the coast that is cold for cool climate varieties like Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, and in this area we have a schist soil. So you have a diversity of climate from the coast to the Andes range, from cool to warm. So a diversity of climate, diversity of soil. We have a metamorphic rock, volcanic rock. So you can develop a wide range of varieties in a very good terroirs in the valley.
And yeah, I want to talk to you in a little bit about all the different wines we're going to be trying later on today. You have a Chardonnay, there's a Pinot Noir, a Carmenera, and a Bordeaux blend-based wines are some of the ones that we're going to be trying today. What's the most difficult thing as a winemaker in that area? What is the biggest challenge?
We are more like a Cabernet Sauvignon country. That's what we've been producing for a long time. The Burgundy varieties were a bit new for us. So we've been learning how to refine the style and how to produce good Pinot Noir and how to improve the finesse of Chardonnay. And I think if you try today what we're doing in Chile in the last 10 years, 7 years, it's been a huge change. Mm. The main change today for me in the last years were how to fine-tune and improve the quality of Burgundy varieties.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's it. And what was the inspiration behind, I mean, beyond the fact that they're delicious? Maybe that's just the answer, but yeah. What was the motivation? With you guys, to go from Bordeaux blends to trying to get Burgundy, that's a hell of a change.
It is. I love Burgundy wines, and we wanted to improve the quality of these wines. Many years ago, 10, 15 years ago, Chile had a very poor plant material. No good clones, not good plant material to produce good Chardonnay.
Yeah.
That was, and we didn't have a lot of cool climate valleys to produce these varieties. So for producing good Chardonnay and good Pinot Noir, you need a cool climate area. So this is why we planted near the ocean, which is a cold place. And we replace and replant and brought good clones from France. So these two things, plus not knowledge. I mean, traveling to Bordeaux, understanding that it's Pinot is like a white with color, and you have to be very gentle and etc. Totally different approach from Bordeaux varieties. The quality today have improved a lot, and the style especially are more refined, elegant, balanced wines, and I'm very happy with that. It's been a big change.
That's fantastic. I can't wait a little bit later on today to try them. What are some of the biggest misconceptions you think that the North American or some parts of Europe they have when they think of South American wine or specifically with Chilean wine?
The big misconception is that considering Chile as a new world wine country, because Chile produced wine since Chile is Chile. The Spaniards arrived with the País or Misión variety in the 16th century. And Chile is a wine country. It's not a beer country. It's not a spirits country. It's a wine country. And wine has been part of the table and the consumption since day one. The thing is that all the production until the beginning of the 90s was for local consumption. Mm-hmm. The consumption in Chile at some point was up as high as 70 liters per person per year, which is huge.
Yeah.
But we didn't export anything until the end of the 80s, beginning of the 90s. So that's why this idea of Chile being sort of a new in wine production, but it's not, in fact.
Yeah, and when I think, you know, Chile or Argentina, everyone just goes, oh, Carmenere and Malbec and just these big fruit bomb wines, when I started studying wine, I didn't realize just the depth of the Bordeaux blend varieties mm-hmm. that Chile is very well known for. That's one of the misconceptions when I started learning about wine that I had no idea that I had to educate myself about.
Yeah. In fact, the Bordeaux varieties were brought in Chile in the middle of the 19th century, in 1850, more or less, before the phylloxera decimated the vineyards in Europe. And we brought Carmenere without knowing. After the phylloxera, the French never planted Carmenere again because it's too late ripening variety. So we got the Carmenere and we kept the Carmenere in Chile. But before that, we were producing wine, a lot of wine in Chile, mainly with Misión variety. So we had dry farming areas in the south, in Itata, in BOV, in many areas. And then Chile started to develop the central valleys and also the coast for producing cool climate varieties. It's been a long process, but Chile produced wines for a long, long, long time.
I read this quote of yours talking about selling the more high-end wines, and certainly you guys produce a lot of that.
Yeah.
Asia versus North America. And in Asia, there's less preconception and the consumer is less experienced, so to speak. They are more open to trying different things. I found that interesting that maybe your $100 plus bottles is easier to sell, you know, to in Asia than it would be to North America.
today Asia as a whole for Vigna Rasuris and also for Chile, especially China, Japan, Korea, is a really big market, very important. But for Vigna Rasuris in particular, UK and Canada are the biggest market, and then Asia as a whole. But I think it's very important to have a market, as you said, that is open to try. But I think that at the same time we should keep caring about those more mature markets that mm-hmm. know about wine and appreciate wine. So this is why we continue to visit these markets and make interviews and presentation, etc. Because experience and knowledgeable is important to develop our brand and the icon wines. Yeah.
How important was it back in May of 2016? James Suckling gave your Chadwick 2014. It received 100 points. And I know that any respectable winemaker does not chase points. Because when you chase points, you usually add a little sugar. You try to, you know, manipulate the wine. But how important was it, you know, just for you, for your winery, and for Chile to for that number?
Well, of course, it was first time, and it was very important for not only for Errázuriz and of course for me, but for Chile to finally have a recognition like that. But I think if you look for the last 5 years, we've been consistently going up in reviews and score, not only with Suckling, mm-hmm. but across the board, in UK, in US, in Canada. And that, for me, is very, very important. Not just one, of course, the 100 points is great, but not just one critic, but being consistent and across the board, better recognition, and it's happening today. Today, yeah. It's Wine Advocate, Wine Spirits, here, John Savo, I know all of them, and UK, and many, it's changing. The perception of what Chile has to offer and the quality and the style, etc., is totally changing in the last 5 years, and it's great.
And, I mean, that's kind of the history of when wine areas become more popular on a global level, is when there are these perception changes. When you know, the famous one where California wines beat the Bordeaux, the Battle of 76, suddenly, okay, American wines can compete, and then more people start drinking it because it almost normalizes the idea that this is high quality. And though you yourself, if you get 199 points, it doesn't change who you are or you as a winemaker, but if it can change the perception of everyone around when they look at Chilean wine and go, oh yeah, that can be on the same level as Italy and France, I guess that can probably have a large impact in terms of sales and just making it easier for you to communicate that, yes, our wine being sold at this dollar is a worthy amount.
Well, it's true. It's an invaluable tool that you can use. But I think today the critics, the media, and the journalists, the sommelier, are convinced that Chile can produce wines that are very interesting, terroir-driven, small producers. The big brands are also producing very interesting and good things. But we have to convince the consumer now. Mm-hmm. It happened already with the critic, with the media, with the sommelier that visit Chile, try the wines. They are convinced that we can produce very good wines. But now we have to take these wines to the table, to the consumer, to take the risk and say, oh, I'm gonna try Chile because I'm sure it's good things. That we're not yet there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's like, hey, it takes time. We're dealing with it, the same thing in Niagara, Prince Edward County, Southern Ontario. There's great wines, and it just, you know, it takes years and years to sort of bust through that wall and break down, you know, the misconceptions.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to be patient.
But, yeah. How did it feel when you won? I know you've won a lot of Winemaker of the Year awards. The first one I can look back at is 2011 Winemaker of the Year by the Chilean Food and Wine Writers Guild. How did that, personally, how did that feel?
I always great to receive recognitions. I try to take it as it is. I'm grateful, but at the same time, I know that I work in a very good winery with very good terroirs, very good fruit, very good team. Mm-hmm. I have all the tools, not to make it good. So I know I have to share that with many, many people.
I like what you did there. Someone, I work in sports radio. You did the classic thing when the guy who wins the MVP and says, not about me, it's about the team, it's about the team. So I like, what are we, and so what are we going to be trying today?
Oh, many, many things. The Costa wines that are from this cool property in near the ocean. So all the Chardonnay, Pinot, New Style, very interesting wines. Then the more inland things, classical Cabernet, Bordeaux varieties. Mm-hmm. And then all our icon wines, including Las Pizarras, which is wines that I love that we developed lately, a top Pinot and a top Chardonnay.
Actually, I would love to ask about the Las Pizarras.
Pizarras.
Yes, thank you. I know it was like the, I think it was 2014. Was that the first time that was? Right?
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could explain just how important this wine is to you, to the winery, and just people what the blend is. And just, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about it.
Sure. The vineyard that we developed was planted in 2005, mm-hmm. 10 kilometers from the ocean, so very cool climate area with a soil that is really is fantastic. It's a schist, it's like a slate.
Yep.
That's why we call pizarras, which is in Spanish the translation for slate. So the profile of the wine that we produce there are very restrained, very linear, very vertical and mineral, very elegant kind of Chardonnay and Pinot. And with time, when the vineyard was older, we decided to go to produce like a top, let's say, Grand Cru, mm-hmm. Chardonnay and Pinot. For that, I hire a geologist from Burgundy to help me to identify the best plots, the soil, the geology, and then the exposure, the material, and tasting. And I have identified a couple of parcels, small parcels, only 3 hectares in Chardonnay and only 5 hectares of Pinot.
Really?
Out of 70 and 50, respectively. And so Pizarras comes only from these specific parcels that we consider to be our Grand Cru parcels.
Oh, that's how. Okay, because I know I gotta let you go soon, but now I'm just curious. When you found those 3 hectares in that 70, what? Just because I think people would be interested, what were you specifically looking for? It's almost like the needle in a haystack for the vineyard. How did you realize this is it? This is the right combination we're looking for.
Well, it's a mix of information from geology, soil, exposure, plant material with tasting. At mm-hmm. the end, the tasting is what defines if it's what I'm looking for or not. But we worked for 5 years to identify these parcels and blind tasting and saying, oh, and at the end, of course, it's a bit arbitrary decision because it's the style I'm looking for, which is a bit more old world, more mm-hmm. Burgundy style. So
yeah.
These parcels give me the most restrained, elegant, mineral style, and it's a very limited area because the soil, the rock, the metamorphic rock is more in surface, is facing south, so it's cooler. The plant material is very good and is consistently giving us the best Chardonnay and Pinot from the property, and Pizarras is that. It's only from these particular parcels.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Before we let you go, how often do you listen to Iron Maiden while making wine?
Oh, I love Iron Maiden. I love rock. I love AC/DC. I used to listen more during harvest. Now it's a bit more complicated, but music is always present in a winemaker's life. Yeah.
Well, Francisco, I really appreciate you joining me for the podcast. I know you got a busy day, so I'll wrap it up here. Otherwise, I could just monopolize you for like another hour. I can't wait to try all the wines, especially I don't drink a lot of Carmenere, so I'm fascinated to try your Carmenere. And, of course, the Burgundian ones is something people just don't usually think about when they think of Chile. So that's going to be great. Francisco, all the best. Good luck to you in the future. And I know it's not for a little while, but happy when you turn 50. happy 50th. And thank you so much for joining me.
And thank you for the opportunity to share and to communicate what we're doing. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find us on Spotify, Stitcher, and iTunes. Happy hunting.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.